today, the United States versus Simmons. Mr. Ali?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Tawfiq Ali. I represent the defendant appellant Alan Simmons. It's undisputed in this case that a bank robbery occurred, and it was committed by two men, Antonio Mann and Mark Campbell, while Mr. Simmons was nowhere near the scene. Now, after Mann and Campbell confessed, they had every incentive to implicate Mr. Simmons in every way. But not even from them was there any testimony sufficient to sustain Mr. Simmons' convictions on armed bank robbery and fireman furtherance of a crime. For three reasons, at least three reasons, Your Honors, you should find that a firearm was not foreseeable to Mr. Simmons as far as the evidence was concerned at trial. First, neither Mann nor Campbell testified that they discussed the use of a firearm with Mr. Simmons. The government's brief makes conclusory statements suggesting that there were statements at trial that Simmons actually did plan to use a firearm, but there were none. That was not the record. Second, the plan that was discussed at trial did not involve a firearm. Both Mann and Campbell testified that the plan that was involved in robbing the bank would be an inside job using Mann's girlfriend and a key to get in, take the money, and get out. Campbell called it a low-risk plan, and he said there was no possibility of getting caught. Mann said his girlfriend was going to help him. And it turned out that his girlfriend had told him information about the security systems at the bank, and his girlfriend told him that it was going to be easy to rob the bank. And third, on the morning of the bank robbery itself, Mann says that it was his plan to abduct his girlfriend, Jackie Schmidt, to make this bank robbery happen. But there was no testimony from Mann or Campbell that this plan was communicated to Mr. Simmons. Nowhere. At most, Mr. Simmons may have understood Schmidt to be a co-conspirator.
What about the fact that Mann brought an unloaded gun during the first robbery attempt? Why wouldn't that be enough for foreseeability?
According to the testimony of Campbell and Mann, Mann brought a gun to the first attempt, but there's no testimony that Mr. Simmons was aware of that gun. The testimony was that Mr. Simmons was at a distance at an ice cream parlor or something to that effect, and Campbell was next to Mann. Campbell may have witnessed the gun, but there's no testimony that Simmons did. Now, with respect to Ms. Schmidt, there was testimony from Mann that the plan involved abducting Ms. Schmidt. But Campbell, who was supposedly the person abducting her, never testifies that it was an abduction. We hear from Campbell that the plan was to meet Ms. Schmidt, who was going to take them to the bank, open the door for them, open the vault for them, let them take the money, and leave in the middle of the night. That was Campbell's understanding. There's no testimony to suggest that that wasn't Simmons' understanding as well. In fact, even Mr. Mann says that it wasn't occurring at the time that they were going to abduct Schmidt. For all these reasons, Your Honors, we suggest that there is no evidence of foreseeability of a firearm to sustain Mr. Simmons' convictions on 2113D or 924C. Second, we also brought up a sufficiency of the evidence point on the 2113D conviction, relying on the putting in jeopardy provision. The government only indicted Mr. Simmons for putting in jeopardy the life of another. In this case, there was an unloaded gun, and the circumstances of the case did not suggest there was any risk, any actual risk of a violent response. And we submit, Your Honors, that there was insufficient evidence to hold Mr. Simmons accountable for armed bank robbery under the putting in jeopardy provision.
Well, couldn't the gun have caused a violent reaction from the victim or the police? Why doesn't that put victims' lives in jeopardy?
In this case, the testimony was that the victim did not resist. And the testimony was that the victim did not even contemplate resisting. There was no actual risk that the victim was going to resist in this case. Furthermore, the bank robbery occurred during non-operating hours. The bank was specifically targeted for a robbery during a time when bystanders would not be present, and it was highly unlikely that police would have been informed in time to create a violent response.
Not from Campbell and Mann, perhaps?
I'm sorry, sir?
Perhaps from Campbell and Mann, if the police responded, might there not be a potential for violence?
If the police had responded, there might have been a potential for violence. But what we're contending here is that there was no actual risk of the police responding in this case because of the circumstances of this case. Pre-operating hours, no bystanders present, no actual risk of the victims actually responding violently. Now, for both of these reasons, we ask Your Honors to find insufficient evidence on the convictions on 2113D and 924C. On the sufficiency grounds, the conspiracy count, there may be a conviction that survives. However, the court should understand it's the object of the conspiracy at most was simple bank robbery, not armed bank robbery. Now, there were also prejudicial, during closing argument, the government inflicted two forms of prejudice. And one of those was including a photograph of Mr. Simmons in closing argument showing him in jail garb. The use of the photograph was entirely unnecessary. And this court has, for 40 years, has admonished against use of photographs of defendants showing that they've been incarcerated or possibly convicted.
How do the jurors know that this is jail garb? It's really kind of a headshot with just a little bit of orange. Orange is associated, I guess, in those of us around the system with jail, but I don't know that the public really sees it that way.
The record shows that both Campbell and Mann had appeared at trial in similar jail garb. Trial counsel pointed that out during his motion for mistrial. The jurors were aware that Mann and Campbell were incarcerated, and the photograph showed Mr. Simmons in similar garb. It also shows Mr. Simmons juxtaposed with mugshots of Mann and Campbell. There could have been no doubt that the photograph there was a prisoner jail photograph.
Well, one of the other shots had an orange, some orange clothing on it, but I can't remember which is which, but the other guy had regular street clothing in it.
That's true.
So I guess I'm having difficulty with your premise that the jurors must have known this was jail garb.
Certainly the jurors had seen them, Mann and Campbell, in jail garb in live full color. And it also, you know, one of those pictures was shown with plain clothing, but it's also clear that that's still a mugshot similar to the other ones.
And in terms of how much time, this thing was only displayed for a very brief period of time.
The record's not entirely clear how long. It may have been up for as much as a minute or two. That's enough time for jurors to infer what the meaning of that photograph
was. But there was as I understood, there was an immediate objection. Right, and the prosecutor took it right down.
We
could also be talking a matter of seconds, couldn't we?
The record's not clear. It's possible that we could be talking a matter of seconds. From what I understood from the record, however, was that this display was presented in front of the jury. It took some time for trial counsel to recognize what was being put up there, and trial counsel objected.
Mr. Alley, do we have from the record an indication of the size of the exhibit?
It doesn't, not in the trial transcripts. Your Honors should have.
We have the, I don't know if that is the actual size, whether it's reduced. That's why the question.
The size.
Do we have a 2x4 or do we have a 8.5x11?
That exhibit should have been provided to you as part of the record. So you'll be able to look at that for yourselves.
Just getting back for a minute to this putting in jeopardy situation. You're not disputing that, you know, when Schmidt gets to the bank, you know, because she's told them that she needs to have a co-worker to open the vault, that the gun was put in Kasten's face. You're not disputing that, that the gun was pointed at her.
No.
Campbell grabbed her and ordered her to give Schmidt the code.
No, Your Honor, we're not disputing that. Ms. Kasten testified to that fact. We're not disputing that. We're only disputing that there was any chance of a violent response under the circumstances.
Now, so the fact that she wasn't armed, that's what we should look at, that Kasten couldn't have responded with a violent response. That's
right.
What we should focus on.
Ms. Kasten was not armed, nor did she contemplate a violent response. There was no actual risk of a fatal response, is the kind of endangerment that we're concerned with when it comes to putting in jeopardy. Now, with respect to the prejudicial errors during closing argument, this court has recognized that a photograph implying incarceration or prior convictions touches on constitutional issues, primarily the presumption of innocence. And in U.S. v. Scott, this court applied a harmless error analysis, harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Based on the weaknesses of the evidence that we've already talked about and the reliance of the government on Mann and Campbell's testimony, two men who had lied several times, the error here could not have been harmless. And we ask that on any count that would otherwise survive sufficiency of the evidence, this court should reverse on all convictions. Now, turning back to the foreseeability issue, we also raise a sentencing issue with respect to the abduction enhancement applied to Mr. Simmons. It's, of course, our contention that there was insufficient evidence to show that the abduction was foreseeable to Mr. Simmons. But even more so, the trial judge did not even make the finding in that case. The court should vacate the assessment of that abduction enhancement. Unless there are other questions, I'd like to reserve my time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Alley. Ms. Watzka.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Kelly Watzka, and I represent the United States in this matter. The defendant has raised a number of issues in this appeal, which I hope have been adequately addressed in the government's brief. I'd like to touch on a few of those issues that the panel has expressed interest in during its questioning of Mr. Ali, beginning with, I guess, the display of Mr. Simmons' mugshot in that summary chart. As in Castaldi, a case recently decided by this court, we concede we had no demonstrable need to use that picture. It was, frankly, a complete oversight on our behalf. But I think, Judge Williams, you kind of picked up on some of the factors that are critical in this court's analysis of whether or not that deprived Mr. Simmons of a fair trial. This display occurred at the conclusion of the trial. It was a 4-day jury trial. All of the evidence was in. The prosecutor had virtually concluded her closing argument at this point and had just displayed the chart and barely had time, frankly, to read the title or the caption of it before there was a defense objection. The record, Your Honor, is not clear about the size. I can tell you, you have a smaller version.
That's what I thought.
That version was placed on an Elmo in the court and then projected onto a larger screen TV, but that is not reflected in the record.
And is the record clear as to how long this display occurred?
It is not entirely clear, Your Honor. Of course, I was there. It certainly was no more than a minute based on the time stamps in the transcript. Essentially, my colleague, Ms. Blackwood, says words to the effect of, "So, ladies and gentlemen, here's our case in a nutshell, United States versus Alan Simmons," and she starts to talk about it. She never gets to the point where she's even noted or addressed Mr. Simmons' picture before there is a defense objection. The chart is immediately removed from the jury's view. The defendant never states in front of the jury the basis for the objection, nor do they ever learn the basis for the objection, and they never see that chart again. We're in chambers talking about the objection where the government argues, look, Judge, we don't think it's prejudicial. They only saw it for a moment. This is an armed bank robbery trial. Certainly the jury, as a matter of common sense, must appreciate that at some point the defendant was arrested, and the district court agreed. He said it's not prejudicial. He very readily reached that conclusion in this case, but in an abundance of caution said, just conclude your remarks without further reference to it, and that's exactly what happened in this case. And
let me ask you this. Yes. Is there a reason that this chart wasn't shown to defense counsel before it was used during closing argument?
There is not a reason, Your Honor.
And is that the normal practice during closing arguments because certainly showing something like this to the defense in advance would take care of objections, or at least the court could rule on them, and that you eliminate the chance of something being shown to the jury.
You're right, Your Honor. And in retrospect, in a perfect world, that's what we would have done. And that's what I'll do the next time around. I found it sort of interesting in Mr. Ali's reply brief, he kind of chides the government for just saying this was a mistake, it was an oversight. But the reality of these, preparation of closing argument summary charts is that they're not prepared until just before closing argument. And, of course, that's because you don't know what evidence is going to get in.
Right, but
they can be shown in the morning.
Right, yeah. I was assistant
You're right.
U.S. attorney.
Right.
I did closing arguments all the time.
Right.
I used charts all the time.
Right.
I turned them over to the defense first thing in the morning, and then we never had an issue. Or if there was an issue, it got cleaned up.
Without a doubt, and we should have done it, without a doubt.
So that will be the practice in the future?
It won't, not at least with respect to myself, that's for sure.
And your office?
Wouldn't be
what
bad.
About your
yeah.
office? Yeah. What about your office?
Well,
what we're saying is it's a practice that should take place in the office, that when they're closing arguments and you want to display a chart, it should be fronted to defense counsel in advance.
And it certainly may be the practice of other colleagues, and I'll certainly share the court's comments this morning with my colleagues. I think that's important. The district court's conclusion that this was not in any way prejudicial to Mr. Simmons is entitled to a highly deferential, high degree of deference. I disagree with Mr. Ali that this is the kind of structural, constitutional error that requires that this court review this case under the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard. That certainly wasn't the standard that this court used in the Castaldi case, which involved the same type of harm. In that case, this court used the abuse of discretion standard. But ultimately, really under either standard, the question at the end of the day is whether this deprived Mr. Simmons of a fair trial, and the answer to that question is absolutely not. The reason that mugshots are disfavored is because they can be indicative of a past criminal involvement. And in this case, the defendant, that wasn't a secret. The defense counsel made a strategic decision during his cross-examination of Antonio Mann to disclose the fact that Simmons is involved, has been involved in selling drugs. And then he argues during closing argument, all those cash purchases made after the bank robbery could have been made with drug proceeds. So, I mean, there's just no reason to believe that the fleeting display of this photograph at the conclusion of a four-day jury trial in any way affected the jury. At best, it simply reminded them of something that they already knew.
Can you move to this kidnapping enhancement? Because
yeah, absolutely.
I'm having some problem with that since Schmidt was the one who gave them the idea to rob the bank. She's the one that told them that her co-worker had to be there with the code. Why wouldn't Simmons assume she was in on it? Couldn't he have assumed that she came voluntarily, that this was just a setup? They're setting it up to pretend like she was abducted so that she has some cover if they're able to get away from it.
Okay, and I guess you're talking about sort of a plausible deniability situation. I disagree with that reading of the facts, and I think perhaps a little bit more context is important here. Antonio Mann never testified. No, there was no evidence that Jackie Schmidt, the bank teller, and his girlfriend said, you ought to rob the bank because it's easy to rob. What the jury heard is that Mann, in his normal conversations with his girlfriend, gleaned information from her. And at one point she made a comment about, our security cameras don't function half the time. For all we know, she was venting about that fact. and she made a comment suggesting that it would be easy to rob the bank. That plants the seed in Antonio Mann's mind. But that it's, I think, not a fair characterization of the evidence to suggest that Jackie Schmidt is, like, actively involved in saying, you ought to do it, and by the way, I need a code. In fact, the record establishes that no one involved in this bank robbery, none of the defendants who were convicted, knew ahead of time that a second teller's code was going to be involved. They fully expected they could go in the middle of the night, take her to the bank, and she could access the vault. And that, in fact, is not true. And if Jackie Schmidt is involved in this case, why do they specifically choose Mark Campbell to go in? Mark Campbell is someone she doesn't know. Why do they send him in with a mask and a gun in the middle of the night, hours before she's going to be even capable of getting them in the bank? I recognize that her decisions and her cavalier attitude towards talking about bank procedures is of concern. It certainly was of concern to the United States and the district court. But there's no evidence on the record, and that's what the district court found, to suggest that she wasn't truly a victim when they decide to go into her home in the middle of the night. Now, with respect to Mr. Simmons' knowledge, I disagree with Mr. Ali that there wasn't, you know, appropriate findings in this case. The pre-sentence report sets forth a prosecutor's version of the offense. And in that version, which was included in the pre-sentence report, it says Simmons and his co-conspirators planned to abduct Jackie Schmidt. Mr. Simmons never objected to that fact. Mr. Simmons objected to application of the abduction enhancement because he made this argument that he claimed that she was a co-conspirator and not an actual victim. And so the district court wasn't really called upon to make an explicit finding of fact that, you know, this was foreseeable to him. The district court was entitled to adopt the findings in the pre-sentence report that Mr. Simmons did not object. And that's exactly what happened here. And that finding is supported by the evidence for a number of reasons. First of all, Mark Campbell, following the first failed bank robbery attempt, gets cold feet. And he tells both Antonio Mann and Alan Simmons, I don't think this is going to work. I don't want to go through with it. And he also says to Alan Simmons, I'm not going to do it again unless you, Alan Simmons, come up with a better plan. Now, Mark Campbell has absolutely no connection to Antonio Mann. They didn't know each other prior to this. Alan Simmons is the common denominator between these two individuals. He has no connection to Mann, and at this point, after the failed bank robbery attempt, he has no reason to have any confidence in him. I mean, Antonio Mann has fallen through the river in the ice. He tries to use a key that he stole to get into the bank, and that doesn't work. So I think it was a reasonable inference from the evidence for the district court to conclude that Mark Campbell is not going to agree to go along with the second attempt unless he's assured that this new plan had Alan Simmons' stamp on it. Okay, so that's reason number one. Secondly, Antonio Mann testifies Alan Simmons is supposed to come up with them that morning. He's supposed to head up to Cedarburg in the middle of the night, and he's still going to serve in this lookout capacity. It's only after they leave, Mann and Campbell leave Milwaukee and head towards Cedarburg, that the phone call comes in and Simmons says, I'm not going to be able to make it. I'm taking care of my kids. I'm not going to get up there. So we have the testimony of Mann saying he's going to be part of this. The other evidence that supports this finding is the phone activity. There were 30 phone calls exchanged between Alan Simmons' phones and Antonio Mann's phones between the time Mann and Campbell leave Milwaukee, head up to Cedarburg, and the time they ultimately flee Cedarburg and head back down to Milwaukee to count the money. The volume of those calls dramatically increases at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and that is significant because it's a reasonable inference is that Alan Simmons knows she's supposed to be abducted about 3:30 in the morning, and he hasn't heard anything. So starting at about 4 o'clock, you see call after call after call, all initiated by one of Alan Simmons' phones, either his cell phone or his home phone. And Mann testifies, it's Simmons calling to say, what's going on? What's happening? Why is it taking so long? Okay, so that's the third reason. And finally, the fourth reason why we ought to believe that this was not only foreseeable to Simmons, but that he had actual knowledge is he was the linchpin of this conspiracy, as the district court found. He was, you know, Mann came up with the idea, but Simmons clearly ran with it from there on out. He controlled every aspect of the planning and oversaw the execution of this bank robbery. He put these two together. He considered multiple individuals to serve in that role, the gunman role, before settling on his cousin, Mark Campbell, who he knew he could persuade. He was there when they were all planning on multiple occasions the bank robbery. He showed up for the first attempt. He encouraged Mark Campbell to go through with it, and he's maintaining constant phone contact with Antonio Mann during the actual abduction and bank robbery. So I am not particularly troubled by the district court's application of the abduction enhancement. I think it was entirely appropriate based on this record. I do want to talk a little bit about I want to correct a comment made by Mr. Ali during his comments, and that is with respect to this issue about the unloaded gun and whether or not anybody's lives were really put in danger. First of all, it's absolutely not true that the bank was not operational at that time. This bank robbery occurred at 7 a.m. That's when the drive-thru opened. Any customer could have pulled up to the window at any point while Mark Campbell's there getting a bag full of money from Jackie Schmidt. The facts are particularly problematic. We've got, regardless of what you think of Jackie Schmidt, she and Mark Campbell are in the drive-thru shortly before 7 a.m., and they're waiting for Marlene Kasten, the second teller, to arrive. When Ms. Kasten walks in, she is grabbed from behind, she's yanked back, turns around and finds a gun, a real gun, pointed at her face. She's then pulled to the ground, where she stays for several minutes with the gun moving between her temple and her chest and her side, while Jackie Schmidt fumbles trying to open the vault. She twice fumbles before she's able to successfully open the vault. And this caused a tremendous amount of frustration to Mr. Campbell. Marlene Kasten testified that Mr. Campbell twice said to her while Jackie's fumbling with the vault, "You wouldn't believe how wrong this has gone. You wouldn't believe how wrong this has gone." And Marlene Kasten testified that she was very concerned about the fact that he was getting frustrated and what might happen next. We also know that Mark Campbell had been heavily drinking before this bank robbery. He stayed out until 2 o'clock in the morning drinking. When Mann picks him up, he can smell alcohol in his breath. So that combination of someone who's frustrated because things are not happening as they should and who may be intoxicated or at least feeling the effects of a night of drinking, that's a volatile situation, and it certainly is not difficult to imagine under those circumstances that Mr. Campbell could have used that pistol to hurt or pistol whip the tellers when he gets frustrated. I mean, that's a circumstance that was specifically contemplated by the Supreme Court in the McLaughlin decision. And so I just don't think there's any basis on these facts for concluding that there wasn't that potential risk for danger to the tellers. Unless the court has any other questions, I'm happy to rest on the briefs. My brief, I'll simply ask the court to affirm. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Watzke. Mr. Alley?
Now, apparently Ms. Watzke and I have a disagreement about the facts here. According to the record, Ms. Kasten gets to the bank at 6:45, 15 minutes before the bank opens. This robbery did not occur during operating times. Second, it's great that the U.S. Attorney's Office will from now on apply good practices, but the prejudice has already been done to Mr. Simmons, and their prospective efforts should not have any bearing on your decision in this case. Now, with respect to the sentencing enhancement, the pre-sentencing report also does not, at least the part that we saw, does not contain a finding on foreseeability from the pre-sentencing writer. This idea that the trial judge adopted the pre-sentencing report and adopted a finding of foreseeability, that just isn't the case. Under the sentencing guidelines, the trial judge must make a finding of fact that when you're going to hold someone liable for co-conspirator liability, the act must have been foreseeable to that defendant. The trial court did not make that finding, and for all the reasons we've stated, the trial court could not have reasonably made that finding. Ms. Watzke refers to 30 phone calls in the middle of the night, but I would like to remind Your Honors that Mr. Mann testified that it wasn't occurring at the time that they were going to abduct Ms. Schmidt. It wasn't occurring at the time. Apparently, according to Mr. Mann, sometime in the middle of the night, the plan had changed. And with respect to the 30 phone calls, if you look at the record, especially transcript pages 493 to 96, you'll see that after 2:30, these phone calls at most are seconds. Some of those are 0 seconds. Some of those are 5 seconds. And these are extremely short phone calls. If they even connected with Mr. Simmons' cell phone, there's no evidence that there was a discussion about a change in plans, about calling this an abduction, as opposed to recognizing Ms. Schmidt as a co-conspirator. I would also like to make sure the court is aware Ms. Schmidt did not testify at trial nor at sentencing. So all the evidence that you heard about the alleged abduction was only from Mr. Mann. And unless there are other further questions, I see my time is up, and I thank Your Honors for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Alley. Thank you, Ms. Watzke. Mr. Alley, I want to extend an additional thanks from the court for your accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Simmons.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. The case is taken under advisement.